All right. 2 Samuel chapter 2. Remember, last time that we were in 2 Samuel chapter 1, that Saul and Jonathan have passed away now, and that David, upon hearing the news, he showed his respect, number one, by executing that Amalekite who had claimed to kill Saul, but then he also wrote that song, the Song of the Bow, and instructed all of Israel to learn that song, and so David showed that really he did honor that position, that place, that office that God had anointed Saul into. Even though Saul really wasn't that honorable, David still honored the position, and we learned a lot from that. So let's go ahead and jump right in here. Chapter 2, starting in verse 1, it says, "It happened after this that David inquired of the Lord, saying, 'Shall I go up to any of the cities of Judah?' And the Lord said to him, 'Go up.' David said, 'Where shall I go up?' And he said, 'To Hebron.' So David went up there, and his two wives also, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and Abigail the widow of Nabal the Carmelite. And David brought up the men who were with him, every man with his household, so they dwelt in the cities of Hebron." So now, we've seen David do some things that weren't too bright. We saw him take off without consulting the Lord and end up living among the Philistines. And we saw over the last few weeks the problems that came from that, from not seeking the Lord and just doing his own thing. Here, David is continuing to do what is right. He's seeking the Lord. He seeks the Lord where he should go. And the Lord tells him, go to Judah and go to the city of Hebron. And David obeys. That's a big thing. That once we know the Lord's will, it's important for us to do it. You know, remember what we saw in 1 Samuel 15. Remember when Saul had, really, this is the biggest thing that got him in trouble, was that he was supposed to go out and wipe out the Amalekites, and he didn't do that. Not the way that he was supposed to. And then Samuel told him, He said in verse 22 of 1 Samuel 15, "Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as is obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams." David here is obeying. He seeks the Lord and then does what he knows he's supposed to do. And that is a good thing that we can learn. A lot of times I'll be in my office and in a counseling situation, and somebody will be asking for direction. What do you think I should do? I really want to know what God wants me to do on this or do that, what job God has for me, whatever. And one of the things that I will usually ask is, well, is there anything that God has already shown you that you're not doing as you should? Because why should God give you more revelation if you're going to disobey what he's already showed you? Here, David, he's got it together now, and he's doing that. But notice that David didn't only bring his family with him, but he brought the guys that were with him, the men, the soldiers that had been hanging with him now for probably over 15 years. These mighty men, they were kind of a ragtag bunch. Remember, they were the outcasts of society, but they proved to be awesome warriors. And in this, that they had really kind of struggled with David in that whole time. They were on the run with David. They suffered with him. And in this situation here, David here is like a type of Christ. That we're told, like in Romans 8:17, that, "And if children, then heirs, heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified together." In 2 Timothy 2, verses 11 and 12 says, "This is a faithful saying. For if we died with him, we also shall live with him. If we endure, we shall also reign with him. If we deny him, he also will deny us." You know, if we're hanging in there with the Lord, if we're faithful to follow him, and sometimes it involves suffering. The Lord warned us that all those who would live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. And from time to time we suffer that. But we have something to look forward to. As we're going through this world, and sometimes it's kind of a drag. Sometimes there's things that that we would rather not go through, but we have that understanding that, you know, if I suffer for the Lord, well, then I'm going to get to enjoy His glory. I'm going to get to be with Him in paradise. And so here David's kind of a type of Christ on that. Now, the first part of verse 4 says, "Then the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah." So, this isn't his first anointing, remember? He has been anointed before by Samuel. I think it was in chapter 10, wasn't it? 1 Samuel, where Samuel had anointed him as king over all of Israel. And there's been now at least 15 years. Some scholars say as much as 40, but probably closer to around 15 years from the time he was anointed as king to right now, where he's actually becoming king and being anointed again, and now taking over as king, at least right now, from the over the tribe of Judah. And in a sense, it's kind of like ordination. These men of Judah finally recognized what God had already done years prior. And really, that's what ordination is. You know, whenever a pastor gets ordained, really, it's not that the denomination or the church board or whatever is ordaining him. It's not that they are placing him into the office or something like that. Really, what it's supposed to be is the men recognizing that God has already ordained that person, that God has already called that person. And so just kind of getting in line with what God has already done. And if you were in a place where you feel like God has called you to maybe a certain position or something like that, and God has done something in your life and you're just kind of waiting for it to happen, and you maybe you're thinking that, you know, nobody is recognizing what God has already done in me. And I know that David had to have felt that at some point. But sometimes we go through that ourselves. You know, that God may put something on your heart and you think, oh, I think God's going to call me to do this or do that. And so you pursue it and just kind of doors get closed and you think, man, well, what's going on here? I really believe God's done it. I know it is, man. It's people. People aren't recognizing what God has already done in me. If that's the case, be patient. You know, David had to be patient here. And if God has called you into a position, He will do it. In 1 Thessalonians 5:24, it says, "He who calls you is faithful, who also will do it." You know, the scripture says that the vision is for an appointed time. There are those times that God will share something with you and then want you to wait. And there have been those times in my life. And I'm glad for them, because during those times of waiting, there were times when I learned a lot. There were those times when I was so glad after going through those times, not always fun, but getting on the other side of them, realizing, wow, I am so glad that God taught me this before He's placed me here. I am so glad for that, because I would have really messed it up more than I already do. So it's important for us just to wait patiently and faithfully, you know, while God is at work, and He's going to work it all out. But we need to be busy about His business while we wait. There's always stuff we can do. And I really think that we need to do what we can while we wait. You know, it's not a thing, well, I'm not going to do anything until God puts me in where He promised to put me, until where I belong, and that's it. I was just sharing with a friend of mine the other day. It's hard to steer a parked car. If you're rolling, then it's easy for God to steer you right to where He wants you. But if you're just parked and saying, I ain't moving, well, then, you know, it's going to be hard to get where God wants you to go. But David, he made his mistakes, but he kept moving. He kept doing what God had called him to do for the most part. He did make some mistakes there, but eventually God has him now where He wants him, and He's bringing him into that place. And we'll see him as king over all of Israel in chapter 5. But right here, it's just over Judah. But I'm sure David was starting to get excited at this point. All right, it's starting to happen now. And then in the rest of verse 4, it says, of the men of Judah, it says, "And they told David, saying, the men of Jabesh Gilead were the ones who buried Saul." So David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said to them, "You are blessed of the Lord, for you have shown this kindness to your Lord, to Saul, and have buried him. And now may the Lord show kindness and truth to you. I also will repay you this kindness, because you have done this thing. Now therefore, let your hands be strengthened and be valiant, for your master Saul is dead, and also the house of Judah has anointed me king over them." Over and over we've seen that David really never was Saul's enemy. Saul thought so, but he wasn't. And David, now, he's respected God's decision, and he blesses these guys of Jabesh-Gilead for what they had done. Remember, because they had gone and really risked their lives in getting Saul's body and Jonathan's and taking them away and cremating them and then burying them so that they couldn't be abused anymore by the Philistines. And so David really blessed them, and he was sincere about this, what they had done for God's anointed. And David recognized this, and all Israel knew that Samuel had anointed king, David as king. Remember, we've seen that over and over again. And they knew that God had chosen him to be the next king. And so now here David uses this occasion, really blessing them. That they've done this thing, and now David's in office, at least partially there. And he blesses them, but he uses this to give them an opportunity to really get in line with God's will. You notice there on the end of that, of verse 7, "And also, by the way, the house of Judah has anointed me king over them." You know Saul's dead, and hey, by the way, you guys know that God's anointed me as the next king, and, Judah's put me in as king. You guys want to have a part of this? You want to get in line with what God is doing here? It's something that, really, I don't believe David was being insincere or that he was just kind of blowing smoke in order to kind of advance his kingdom kind of deal. He wasn't just buttering them up. I really believe that he was sincere in blessing them, but he's using wisdom in the occasion. He's kind of calling them to the fact that Saul's dead, and God has anointed me as king. Hey, the men of Judah have made me king. And so, he's doing both. He's being sincere and blessing them, but he's also being wise. In Matthew 10:16, Jesus said, "Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves." It is possible to do both. And David here is being as wise as a serpent, but, he's being as harmless as a dove, too. He's not stirring up any trouble. He's not saying, "Hey, or else," kind of thing, but he's just kind of reminding them what's going on. Verse 8, however, "But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, took Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. And he made him king over Gilead, over the Asherites, over Jezreel, over Ephraim, over Benjamin, and over all Israel. Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel, and he reigned 2 years. Only the house of Judah followed David. And the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. Abner was Saul's cousin. Remember, we saw that when we were first introduced to him. But he was the commander of Saul's army. And really a pretty powerful guy. He was the guy, remember, that David mocked when he went in there and stole Saul's jug of water and Saul's spear. Remember, he taunted Abner about not doing his job and that he deserved to die for letting somebody in the camp. But Saul has a real stake in somebody, or rather Abner has a real stake in somebody from Saul's lineage staying in office. He's really now the most powerful guy in Israel. He's the most influential and all that. And he takes Saul's, what most people believe is his youngest son, and he puts him in, really is kind of a puppet leader. This guy Ishbosheth is really a wimp. His name, Ishbosheth, is literally man of shame. At least that's how it is here in this account. Now, if you look at, and you don't have to turn there, but in, you can look it up later on, in 1 Chronicles 8:33 and chapter 9, verse 39, he's referred to as Esh Baal. And what most scholars believe, the reason why there's a difference there, is because Esh Baal, which meant man of the master or man of the Lord, at that time, Baal kind of simply meant Lord. And it could refer to kind of any kind of Lord. Could have been a pagan Lord, could have been Yahweh. But over the years, Baal became totally identified with the Canaanite pagan deity, Baal. And so the scribes that were copying the names here, they changed the Baal part to Bosheth and made it, you know, changed it from Lord to shame, so as not to kind of think that that the Jewish leadership was involved in pagan worship. Although we know before and later on they will be involved in pagan worship. But you can check out 2 Samuel 11:21 when we get there. You'll see it. But they refer to, remember Gideon, his other name was Jerubbaal. Okay, here in 2 Samuel chapter 11, he's called Jerubbaal-Bosheth. I have a problem with that name. But anyway, so just in case you read that and maybe you look over there to 1 Chronicles and you see the difference there that, hey, he was the father of this and that, and you don't get confused there. That's what's going on. A copyist probably changed it at some point so as not to give any kind of glory to Baal, the pagan deity. Also, in verses 10 and 11, you see that Ishbosheth reigned for 2 years, and then David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah. He reigned there 7.5 years, 7 years, 6 months. You see that? Now, some people point to that and go, hey, there's a contradiction there. There seems to be a contradiction, but really, there's not. A couple of ways to explain that is that there could have been some time between the time that Saul died and when Ishbosheth, his son, began his reign. But also, more than likely, there was a lot of time between Ishbosheth's death and when David moved his headquarters from Hebron up to Jerusalem. So that would explain it the best, I think. But here, Abner is clearly out of God's will. He has put this guy in place, really as a puppet, and we'll see a little bit that really Ishbosheth is scared to death of Abner. He won't even confront him. And I think we'll see that in the next chapter. But at one point, Abner gets in his face. And Ishbosheth, the king, doesn't do a thing about it. Doesn't even answer him. And the Bible tells us, because he was afraid of him. So he puts him up there really as a puppet ruler. And he's totally out of God's will because Abner knew that God had ordained David to be the next king over all of Israel. And later on, in a couple of chapters, we'll see him actually kind of get in line with that. But it's really not from a good thing. It's just from pride when things don't go his way. But anytime a leader is out of God's will, there's always problems. Spiritual leadership, political leadership, whatever. Leaders get out of God's will, you got problems. Verse 12, it says, now Abner, the son of Ner, and the servants of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out and met them by the pool of Gibeon. So they sat down, one on one side of the pool, and the other on the other side of the pool. Now, this part right here is getting to a real interesting part. It's kind of goofy. You know, it's almost bizarre, really. But Mahanaim was east of the Jordan. It was quite north of this area of Gibeon. And Gibeon was about 6 miles northwest of Jerusalem. Hebron, where Joab and David and all those guys were, that's about 19 miles southwest of Jerusalem. So they kind of meet in the middle there at this pool. And this pool is about 36 foot in diameter. Archaeologists have uncovered it. You can look on the web and find pictures of it. It's pretty cool looking, actually. This is huge, huge, like about 36 foot around and about 30 feet deep. And they've got this kind of spiral set of stairs that I think there's like 79 steps that take it all the way down to the bottom. So that way when the water level would go down, the women drawing the water could go down and get their water. So they wouldn't have to lower ropes down to get the water. They just walk down the steps and then get it. So it's this big, huge, huge pool, they're calling it. It's really a man-made well that was dug out of solid rock there. Now, verse 14 says, "Then Abner said to Joab, 'Let the young men now arise and compete before us.' And Joab said, 'Let them arise.'" Now, that word compete is, in some translations, contest. Let them have a contest. And it's a word, that word in the Hebrew can be translated to laugh, to play, or to make sport, and that's how it's used here. It's not a real violent word. And it's kind of like, hey, let's let them have a game of football or soccer or a wrestling match. Let's have some kind of a contest and we'll see who's got the better side here. So get that picture there, okay? There's two groups around this big pool, and they're both their armies. And not huge, they don't have a whole lot of them, but there may be, I don't know, 400, 500, 1,000 of them kind of thing on each side of this pool. And the two leaders, hey, let's have a contest. Yeah, okay, let's do it. And so, verse 15, they arose and went over by number, 12 from Benjamin, followers of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 from the servants of David. And each one grasped his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in the opponent's side. So they fell down together. Therefore, that place was called the Field of Sharp Swords, or Swords, which is in Gibeon. They clearly had no grasp of sportsmanlike conduct. You know, remember, this word is contest. It's not a word that was like a word for fighting to the death. It's okay, let's have a contest. So they go out there, you know, a dozen guys from each side and grab each other's head and stab each other in the side. And the word could be translated sword or daggers. And you look at this, you go, well, this is supposed to be a sport. It got out of hand. Just like, you know, you see what happens like at soccer tournaments and stuff like that, how the players and the fans go nuts and gets out of hand. And that happens a lot of times. There's a lot of tension in between these two groups. And as I was studying for this, I started thinking about the Capital One commercial, you know, the barbarian guys. And I started imagining those guys, you know, grabbing each other and all that. And there they are. There's 24 of these contestants now dead on the ground. And then it breaks out into all-out war. They start, you know, killing each other and all. And it kind of like, again, at the sports things, how they will get into it. A couple of players will get into it. Then they empty the benches. And that's what's happened here. And we'll see that here in just a minute. In chapter, in verse 18, it says, "Now the three sons of Zeruiah," remember that's David's sister, Zeruiah, "were there, Joab and Abishai and Asahel." And Asahel, or Asahel, was as fleet of foot as a wild gazelle. And so Asahel pursued Abner. And in going, he did not turn to the right hand or to the left from following Abner. Then Abner looked behind him and said, "Are you Asahel?" And he answered, "I am." And Abner said to him, "Turn aside to your right hand or to your left, and lay hold of one of the young men and take his armor for yourself." But Asahel would not turn aside from following him. Now, it sounds kind of confusing. What? Turn aside and get with these young men. The New Living Translation words verse 21 is, Abner turned around and says, "Go fight someone else," Abner warned. "Take on one of the younger men and strip him of his weapons." But Asahel kept right on chasing Abner. This guy is like a guided missile after Abner. And he's a young man. He's Joab's youngest brother. And he is not a seasoned warrior like Abner. Remember, Abner was the commander of Saul's army. He's been in a lot of battles. This guy's a tough guy. And he turns around and sees this kid running after him. "Are you Asahel?" "I am." "You know, go away. You know, get out of here. Go pick on one of these younger guys over here. If you got to take a trophy home or something, you know, kill one of those guys, take his armor and stuff, and be on your way." And I really, you know, as you're going to see, I really don't think that Abner wanted to kill this guy. You know, he's just a young kid. There's no glory in it or whatever. And that, but Asahel might have been fast, but he wasn't very tough. He really wasn't very smart either. Look at verse 22. Says, "So Abner said again to Asahel, 'Turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I face your brother Joab?' However, he refused to turn aside. Therefore, Abner struck him in the stomach with the blunt end of the spear, so that the spear came out of his back, and he fell down there and died on the spot. So it was that as many came to the place where Asahel fell down and died, they stood still." You know, it's possible that his spear was pointed on the, what they're calling the blunt end. It's literally the back end of the spear. It's possible. We saw it, well, I just talked about it, when David went into Saul's camp and grabbed his spear. Remember, the spear was stuck in the ground. And archaeologists say that the soldiers would kind of put a point on the other end of the spear just so they could stick it in the ground and they wouldn't dull the tip that they would fight with. And so, you know, he hits him with the spear and, you know, it might have been pointed, or it just might have been, Asahel was just so skinny that the blunt end just went right through him. You know, that would explain how fast he was, you know, being real skinny. If you ever seen the runners, you know, marathon runners and stuff, they're bean poles. But it goes right through him. Yeah, he's like, "Ew." And it says that everybody, when they would pass by him, you know, remember, they're being pursued. Abner and his men are on the run now. They just had this contest, and it spills into a full-blown war here. And Abner and his men take off. They're running for their lives, literally. And Asahel is following after. You know, the rest of the guys, we'll see it in just a second, Joab and the rest of them, they are chasing after them as well. But Asahel is way out in front. He is fast, and he should have hung back with his brothers and the rest of the guys, but he wouldn't let up, and he gets it. And now, as all the soldiers would run by, they'd stop and look at him. "Oh, bummer." You know, maybe he was out of respect. Maybe he was just like, "Ew, gross." You know, maybe he had stuff hanging out, you know, and all that. Hey, it was war, right? But here's something to think about. Okay, I mean, it's kind of funny, you know, all that kind of stuff. But really, think about this. Asahel's greatest strength actually led to his death. Think about that. God has given all of us different gifts. He's given all of us different strengths. We all have different strengths. We all have different weaknesses, don't we? And there are those times that our strengths can get us into trouble. Whatever God has gifted you with, you need to make sure, real sure, that you're going to Him and getting wisdom from Him in how to use that strength, whatever God has done. You see it in smaller things, like, and it is really when you're in it, it's really not a small thing. But maybe, you know, from time to time you see, you know, a woman that may be gifted with great spiritual insight. You know, she reads the scriptures and just getting all kinds of stuff out of it, but she has to be careful not to usurp her husband's position as the spiritual head of the house. That happens. And that's why I said I refer to it as a smaller thing, but if you're in that situation, it can be pretty ugly. Or a husband may be very gifted in running his business, but he's got to be careful not to try and run the home like he does the business, because that can be very, very frustrating for the wife and all that. Hey, look, you're not at work anymore, pal. He's up, kind of thing. I remember listening to James Dobson years and years ago. This is probably 25 years ago. And I remember him talking about our strengths can sometimes be a problem if we don't know when to use those gifts and when not to and all that. And he talked about this one guy that, and it's a true story, that this guy was a very well-known and well-respected CPA in his town, that he had all of the major businesses and all that because he had the reputation of being a CPA that just didn't let anything slip by. He caught all of the mistakes that other people made, and he would check and double check and triple check, and his work was just flawless. But that spilled over in the home. They would get ready to leave the house, and he'd ask his wife, "Did you lock the back door?" "Yeah, I got it." And he'd turn right around and go to the back door and check the back door. It drove his wife nuts. You ask me what I do. I just double check, you know. And we have to. That's kind of a small thing, but we do have to be careful about that. But you know, something much worse though, that God gifts certain people to lead other people, and we've seen those people use that gifting for their own personal gain, where they turn people to themselves, or they use it for really making money off of the people. You turn on TV and you see it quite often, where a half-hour TV program is 20 minutes of raising money kind of thing. And they use the gift that God has given to them just so that way they can benefit from it and profit from it. And it's really disastrous for the leader as well as those that follow that kind of a leader. And we have to be very careful with what God has given to us. We have to use our gifts that we're commanded to. We don't want to neglect the gift that is in us. You know, both times when Paul wrote to Timothy, he had to tell Timothy, stir up the gift. And say, don't neglect the gift kind of thing. We have a tendency of not wanting to use those gifts that God has given to us. But when we do use them, we must use them with the grace that God gives us. We must use them according to the amount of faith that God gives us. But also we have to ask for wisdom and guidance in how to use the gifts and that, so that we're not outside of God's will and we don't cause damage. In Romans 12:3 it says, "For I say, through the grace given to me, to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith." Asahel thought too highly of himself. He set his sights on Abner, which was, you know, way beyond his ability, way beyond what God had gifted him to do. It was one of those things where, you know, the old saying, your mouth is writing checks that your body can't cash. And Asahel found that out. He thought way too much of himself, and he paid the price. Verse 24 says, Joab and Abishai also pursued Abner. See, the rest of the guys were coming, but just Asahel was way out in front. It says, "And the sun was going down when they came to the hill of Ammah, which is before Gia, by the road to the wilderness of Gibeon. Now the children of Benjamin gathered together behind Abner and became a unit and took their stand on top of a hill. Then Abner called to Joab and said, 'Shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that it will be bitter in the latter end? How long will it be then until you tell the people to return from pursuing their brethren?'" So Abner, he's had enough of this. He's turned around enough already, you know. This isn't going to end well. Besides, we're brothers. And remember, Abner has now, we just read here, that he's just been reinforced with fresh troops from Benjamin. They had gathered together with them. So maybe that helped to sway Joab's mind there, to kind of get him to cool his heels a little bit. In verse 27, it says, "And Joab said, 'As God lives, unless you had spoken, Surely then by morning all the people would have given up pursuing their brethren. Now, it's kind of an awkward translation there. The NET Bible words it a little bit easier to understand. It says, Joab replied, as surely as God lives, if you had not said this, it would have been morning before the people would have abandoned pursuit of their brothers. So basically Joab's saying, well, you know, it's good thing you called us off. Good thing you said enough, because we would have pursued you guys till morning. And God was blessing Joab and their group, and it's real possible they could have won even with the reinforcements from Benjamin. But look at verse 28 now. It says, so Joab blew a trumpet, and all the people stood still and did not pursue Israel anymore, nor did they fight anymore. Then Abner and his men went on all that night through the plain, crossed over the Jordan, and went through all Bithron, and they came to Mahanaim. So Joab returned from pursuing Abner. And when he had gathered all the people together, there were missing of David's servants 19 men and Hazael. But the servants of David had struck down of Benjamin and Abner's men 360 men who died. Then they took up Hazael and buried him in his father's tomb, which was in Bethlehem. And Joab and his men went all night, and they came to Hebron at daybreak. So Joab blows the horn, calls off his men, and Abner goes home to Menahem. And you say it a bunch of times, you know. And then Joab does a roll call, and come to find out, there's only 20 of his men missing. 19 plus his youngest brother. Those were the only ones that were killed. But Abner lost 360, and that's why I say that there could have been 500, there may have been 1,000 men there. But Abner lost 360 men. And they buried Hazael in Bethlehem. It was pretty close to Hebron, and then they returned to their headquarters in Hebron. Some kind of bizarre stuff there in this chapter, but I think there's things, you know, that we can learn from that, as, you know, like we saw as David rewarded his men by keeping them with him, and they ended up being leaders in his kingdom. You know, we need to be willing to suffer as we wait for the Lord. If God calls us to suffer, then we need to suffer. But whatever comes our way, we need to endure it. And like we saw in Romans 8:17, if indeed we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified together. We need to be patient as we wait for the Lord to use us. Whatever God has called us to, whatever you believe that God has called you to, that, okay, but the vision may be for an appointed time, and you need to patiently wait and be busy about his business while you wait. And then, whatever your position, seek to stay in God's will. Nothing but trouble if you don't. And then also, don't let things get out of hand, like the contestants there and the rest of the army. You know, that, remember, one of the fruits of the Spirit, which is supposed to be evident in our lives as believers, one of the fruits of the Spirit is self-control. And so, no matter what, we should be able to exercise that self-control. And you want to keep yourself in check so that you don't let your emotions carry you away into something that you end up regretting, as these guys no doubt did. And also, wherever God has gifted you, seek God's will and his wisdom in exercising your gifts. And the body will be blessed because of it. Let's stand up and pray.